I mean, that's us. That's a, we're a, we're a small team of trivia hounds who love what we do. We work out of an old station master's house in a tiny little town in the woods.
That's Brian Uncle John Boone, and I'm Dan Skinner. This is Conversations. Brian Uncle John Boone is a writer who's published books about music, sports, literature, as well as a book of jokes. He's also authored thousands of articles for the Uncle John's Bathroom Reader series, and that's just a few of his many credits. He joins us to talk about the 38th book in the series, Uncle John's Know-It-All Bathroom Reader. Brian, welcome to Conversations.
Thanks for having me on. It's great to be here. Nice to see you.
Now, for those who aren't familiar with this long-running series of books, what can a person expect to find when they pick up one of these bathroom readers?
You know, virtually anything that's interesting to them. We designed these to be suited to, you pick it up at random and you can flip to almost any page and you'll find something that suits you before long. We've got a little bit of science, a little bit of history, pop culture, word origins, origins of everyday things, just a little bit of something for everybody. Just it's a big world out there, and there's a lot of interesting stories to cover, and we have stories of different lengths to, you know, depend on however you need to use it as well.
And the Bathroom Reader Institute keeps coming up with more stuff, and this time it's the Know-It-All edition, and there's no way we can cover everything here, because literally there are thousands of things here for people to look at. But let's start with just one, and that's about comic books and kind of the, you know, comic book junk sort of thing. Tell us about it.
I was always fascinated by, you know, the stuff in the back of a comic book or Boys Life magazine, that stuff that you could, you know, send your dollar or your money order away for, you know, the Sea Monkeys, the X-ray specs. And I never got any of it because my mom, you know, warned me like, oh, it's going to be junk. It's going to be a scam. So I looked it up and she was right. It's mostly garbage. But I was curious, like, how those famous X-ray specs works, you know, with the glasses with the swirls on the eyes. And apparently what they are is two very thin discs of paperboard, and they would embed a bird feather between them. So it would create this optical illusion where the light would make the images you see offset and dark, but with a kind of a shadow around them. So you hold up your hand in front of your face, like in the ad, and there'd be a barrier around. So it would look like an X-ray, but it wasn't really an X-ray. It was just a very cheap knockoff.
My favorite one from those, because I remember them well, is the pseudo diamonds. And from the genuine pseudo diamond, you know, mine, and they just made, you know, they were assuming the kids wouldn't know what pseudo meant.
Right. It sounds fancy. It sounds, you know, oh, they're extra diamonds, but they were honest with you. They were pseudo diamonds.
Yeah. We obviously live in a time now where we have lots of channels to choose from with, you know, streaming and cable, et cetera. But in one portion of your book, you talk about some channels that we've probably all forgotten about that came on the scene and didn't last very long.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, in the 80s, cable was kind of the Wild West of TV. Like, all of a sudden, you know, you didn't have three channels anymore. You could have hundreds, and, you know, every channel could focus on just one thing. And nobody thought they would work. Like, CNN came out in 1980, and nobody thought an all-day news network would work. But before that, there was another all-day news service called UPI News Time. And it was run by the UPI, which was a radio and print news service. And what they would do, they made this channel as cheaply as possible. They would just take stock press images, black and white in the age of color TV, and just kind of pan and scan across them with the camera while they played the radio news feed over it. They would just play the same chunk of news that's 15 minutes long. They'd play that for 4 hours, you know, ads after every break. And then every 4 hours, they'd get a new section of news. When CNN came out, like, UPI News Time just couldn't handle it. It was, you know, CNN had, you know, live video and color and anchors and video and things like that. So it went down pretty quick after that.
There was also something called Sumo TV.
Yeah, that was I think cable TV operators saw the writing on the wall when YouTube came out. They're like, this is going to kill us. Like, people could watch whatever they want, whenever they want. So they started this network called Sumo TV, where it was curated YouTube videos. And it did well for a while. basically because it advertised YouTube. They competed with themselves, essentially. In England, they had to adhere to broadcast standards, so that limited what they were able to show from YouTube on broadcast television. And in the US, it just, you know, turned everybody onto YouTube who watched it. They're like, oh, there's this thing on my computer that I can go watch, and I can watch whatever I want. I don't have to wait for them to watch it. So it's just very much an example of a shifting point in how we consume television.
Yeah. And speaking of YouTube, at the bottom of every page, there are just sort of little one or two liners of trivia. So you don't waste any space in this book. You put information wherever you can find it. And one of the little bits of information was, and I'll probably get the numbers not exactly right, but it was said something to the effect that if the 67 million YouTubers were all together in one place, they'd form the 25th largest nation in the world.
Yeah, isn't that wild? Yeah, we love those little facts. Like, just there's always a way we can shove in a fact at the bottom of the page. I think my favorite one in the book is Henry Heimlich, inventor of the Heimlich maneuver, only used his technique once, and it was when he was 96 years old, and it was when he was living in an assisted care facility, and one of the other residents was choking, and here comes Henry Heimlich to deliver the Heimlich maneuver.
There's a lot of history here. You know, there's a lot of fun stuff, but that doesn't mean that history can't be fun. And one of the things you talk about are states and cities that, when they were being formed, they were kicking around ideas about, you know, what they might be called. And it would have been interesting if some of these had turned out instead of, you know, what they actually ended up being called.
Oh, it's absolutely wild, because when Washington became a state in 1889, it was previously the Washington Territory, and they didn't really think much of it. They had named it after George Washington, of course. So when it became a state, Congress was concerned that people would confuse it with Washington, D.C., because it's virtually the same name. So somebody in Congress, in all their infinite wisdom, suggested that they name it Columbia. And then somebody else pointed out, well, then that's still the same as Washington, D.C., because that's what the C in Washington, D.C. stands for. But I think it's interesting that there's 31 Washington counties across the U.S., but there are none in Washington state.
Another section of your book deals with slang, and that's entertaining because it's constantly changing. But there's a section of the book that talks about Antarctic slang that, you know, I'd never heard of before.
Yeah, even Antarctica. I've always been obsessed with subcultures and how they all have their own slang and their own language among them to differentiate themselves from one another. And even in Antarctica, where there's no permanent population, they have their own words that just they keep passing down through the years. You know, all the scientists there, they call each other beakers for scientists. A USARP is an American scientist because they're part of the United States Antarctic Research Program. A whale that they see, they call that a wolf of the sea. To trek across the wilderness is to yomp. A male seal is called a wig. And while they're tromping around the wilderness, if they happen to come across frozen animal dung, which they do because it's cold, they call that a tertsicle.
In the book, you also highlight some interesting research projects and the conclusions they came to. And one of them had to do with dogs dreaming and that they dream about their owners. And I'm thinking, well, how in the world would they determine that?
I've read it over and I can't quite figure out how. I think it's mostly just a strong suggestion. It's a theory. Deidre Barrett, a clinical psychologist at Harvard, wanted to know this. So she spent years studying dogs. She did not let sleeping dogs lie. She just kept studying dogs and noticed that when they sleep, they exhibit the same behaviors as humans do. You know, they'll vocalize, they move around, they do the rapid eye movement. And so she determined that because humans dream while we're doing those things, that dogs must too. And because humans dream about, you know, whatever is going on in our daily lives and however weird a way that we do that, the dogs do that too. So your dog is probably, if your dog is, you know, laying there on the ground and he's it looks like he's running a little bit, he's probably thinking about going on a walk with you, or he's dreaming of your face or even your smell.
Well, I get the dreaming part, but, you know, they could be dreaming about chasing a rabbit. Who knows?
Sure.
Another study in there had to do with fists. And although I see, you know, practically, yep, people do use fists for punching things, but why would research determine that that's the purpose of a fist?
Because previous to this, we thought that the human hand evolved the way that it did was in order to make tools or to climb on trees. And there's fossil evidence that supports this, but this new study by David Carrier at the University of Utah found that we're basically the only primates that could make fists, which suggests that we were a much more aggressive species earlier than previously thought, because we're the only people who can make fists, and it's shaped in such a way as to limit damage to the hand after stroking something.
Point out again that the wide variety that is in this book, there are all sorts of lists, which are kind of fun. In fact, there was one list that was just pointing out that of the books that were coming out recently, a lot of them ended with the word nation. And there was just a whole list of, I don't know, 50 or 100 books that were named Nation. You know, we've touched on just a few things, but what are some of your favorite of the many thousands of things in this book that come to your mind?
Oh, I love the Dumb Crooks articles that we do. That's probably what fans tell us is our favorite. We just get these stories about criminals who got caught because they did something stupid. This man named Michael Gale Nash in Alaska in 2018, he got caught robbing a bank because he slipped a note across the counter and was on the back of one of his own deposit slips. So it had his own name and his address on it. And then he got caught pretty quick, gets out of prison a year later, goes back to the same bank, and he got there before they opened, slipped a demand note under the front door. And then an employee saw it, called the cops, and then they opened at 10 a.m. The guy walks in the bank, gets arrested.
Tell us a bit about the Bathroom Reader Institute, and how do you put these books together each year?
I mean, that's us. We're a small team of trivia hounds who love what we do. We work out of an old station master's house in a tiny little town in the woods. We get everything from everywhere. I think we're all just finely tuned to story generation and picking up ideas. Like, you know, I'll be walking around and I'll see something, or I'll see something on my desk. I'm like, oh, that's, what if the origin story of that is? Or read a magazine article. People send us a lot of articles from their newspapers, or we'll hear something on the radio, see a documentary, and just kind of slowly over the course of a year, just put different pieces together into an article. And then we make those articles into a book.
Brian Uncle John Boone joined us to talk about Uncle John's Know-It-All Bathroom Reader. It's the 38th book in the Bathroom Reader series. Brian, thank you very much for talking with me today.
Thanks for having me. It's always fun.
You'll find more interviews on a wide variety of topics at kansasradio.org/conversations. You can use the KPR app to listen to the latest episodes on your phone or tablet, and you'll also find us on Facebook. I'm Dan Skinner. Thanks for listening.